working. So I'm part of the, or I went through the California-Hawaii Public Health Leadership Institute with under the Public Health Institute, and Carol Waltron is the director of that institute, and she just walked in and is sitting in the front row there. And it's 2 years, and I was part of the first class that went through, and it's really an institute, a great opportunity for public health department staff from local public health departments to participate in this institute. 1 year project, we can talk about this in more detail later, but it has a retreat. It's really about creating a learning community, and there are several retreats, webinars, and an action learning project. So what I want to do is, here we go, talk a little bit about my journey and how I got here, what our public health department is trying to do to achieve health equity, and then some of the lessons learned, both in terms of personal and organizational lessons learned. So the first thing I'm sharing here is a picture of my journey. This was one thing that you can tell immediately from me is I'm a horrible artist, because this is like really elementary. But the exercise that we did was really sort of having a chance to talk about where we come from, what our values are, and who we are. And so this was a journey that we used as a team building exercise with staff in my department. And the things that I want to share are, I'm Latina. My parents are Ecuadorian. I was born in this country. My dad came to this country to pursue his education and a degree in water supply and sanitation, civil engineering. And right after that, he got a job with the World Health Organization. And in India and Brazil, which is where I spent most of my childhood, his job was really trying to build technical capacity of both engineers around water supply and sanitation, but also around community members and villagers around how to develop and maintain their water supply and sanitation systems. So this is supposed to be a pump, but it's not so good. And a couple things about that I think that are really meaningful to me as I have moved forward in this journey. One is just being exposed to the huge inequities, the social inequities that you see in countries like India and Brazil, and the fact that there is something you can do about it. So both really being exposed to the extremes and also recognizing that you actually can do something about it. And the second piece really is something that has been very dear to me, which is this notion of building capacity of people that are most impacted to find solutions and make the changes. So really building from my father's teaching and training in terms of that. And so those are both things that I carry very close into my heart. So fast forward a bit, pursued studies in sociology and anthropology and Latin American development, really focusing on the social, political, economic context of health, and then realized, wow, I'm really interested in health. I'm coming at it from a whole bunch of different angles, but I'm really, really interested in health, and had an opportunity to work for the International Research, IDRC, International Development Research Center out of Canada, which, again, was really about trying to build up the capacity of researchers in Latin America, Asia, and Africa to do their own research and keep that knowledge in their communities, because at that time, it was mostly foreigners coming into those countries, doing research, taking that information back out. So all of this theme of building capacity has been something that's been really clear in what I do. And then went to graduate school and got a doctorate in public health. And right after that, got a job in Alameda County, where I've been for the last 12 years. So leadership, just to say a little bit about leadership. Leadership's kind of a funny thing. You know, I never really thought of myself as a leader until someone came. Some of you may know Dr. Sherry Pies. She was doing a class on leadership at the School of Public Health, and she said, you know, we really want you to come and be on this panel on leadership. And I was like, no, you don't want me. You want my boss. My boss is really good at this and this and this and this. And she's like, no, we want you. And I'm like, well, why do you want me? And she was like, because I've been hearing around, and at the local level, people think of you as a leader. And so that was like this first time that all of a sudden it was like, whoa. And it was kind of scary, honestly, because I was just, you know, I had my head down to the ground doing my work, you know, just doing the work. And so that was sort of the first time that this whole concept of leadership came. And it's something I've had to it hasn't been easy to grow into this notion that you actually are some sort of leader, whatever that means, that you're a leader. So it's been a journey. The other thing I think is also just that really it forced me to recognize that there's informal and formal leaders, right? And no matter where you are, you can be a leader. And I think that was part of what I also really have learned from this, and that there's a role for everybody. And so you can lead anywhere you are. There's movement forward, and around social equity, health equity, and social equity, it's key to really create those opportunities for leaders to come from many different places. So in the public health department, our mission is to ensure the optimal health and well-being for all people. And clearly, that's not what's happening in many of our communities. How we think about it is really that place, income, and racism really matter and impact health. So I wanted to just provide the context within which we're working, right? So compared to a white child in an affluent hill area, an African-American child born in West Oakland is 1.5 times more likely to be born premature and low birth weight, 7 times more likely to be born in poverty, 2.5 times more likely to be behind in vaccinations, 2 times more likely to die of heart disease. And all of this cumulative impact really accumulates to an impact of a 15-year difference in life expectancy. So a 15-year difference in life expectancy in a geographic area that's less than 2 miles from one place to the other, right? So this is the context that we're talking about when we're talking about social justice and health equity. And we name it racism from the get-go. Because as Kamara Jones talks about that, and actually Dr. Jenkins also talked about this at his keynote, it's not race that's the issue, right? It's racism that's the issue. And Dr. Kamara Jones talks about that race is often just used as a proxy for racism. And so we just go ahead and call it what it is. When we're talking about health inequities, we talk about health inequities, we don't talk about health disparities. And again, I think this audience will know this really well, but we're really talking about differences in health that are unnecessary, avoidable, unjust, unfair, beyond the control of an individual. And so again, that's our framing, and I really like this phrase. Health equity is about achieving the highest level of health for all people. It entails focused societal efforts to address avoidable inequalities by equalizing the conditions for health for all groups, especially for those who have experienced socioeconomic disadvantage or historical injustices, such as racism. And so I think the piece about leadership and leading around social equity is really staying focused on the vision of where we're trying to go. Because it's really because we hear the talk a lot now, you know, real social justice, health equity, but really figuring out what you have to do and what that looks like in practice, I think is a real challenge. And while it seems like everything should be very clear cut, if you're going to be a social justice public health department, very clear what you should be doing, there really are lots of shades of gray in this work. There's policy trade-offs, there's tricky situations with partners, there's a focus there's a tendency to focus externally as opposed to really addressing institutional issues within your own institution around equity and justice. There's capacity issues, having to learn as a health department how some of these broader determinants impact health. So there and very differing perspectives of what to do. So I think that for me, it's really about focusing on the vision, even when it's not clear what our path is all the time, because part of this is we're trying desperately to develop a practice, a public health practice that really focuses in on this. There's copies of the presentation. I'm not going to go through every slide, so I won't go into this in a lot of detail, but we really use a framework for health equity that really acknowledges that a lot of the work that we do in public health is around the medical model, and that's really important, and people absolutely need services, and we need to continue to do a good job doing that and be effective and efficient doing that. We also really need to sort of focus on why is there such a need for those services to begin with, and it's not random that there's the need for the service. There's particular communities and populations that really need those services, and really thinking about how decisions get made about why certain neighborhoods and places look the way they do, and then really going further to think about values and you know, part of how our decisions historically have been made are because we value certain people more than we value other people, right? And so that moves into the whole mix of valuing and policies and practices that benefit certain populations over others. So that is our framework. And what I'll share with you is what we're doing to try to achieve this very, very quickly. So when we talk about trying to achieve health equity in Alameda County, we talk about that everyone, no matter the color of your skin, no matter where you live, and no matter how much money you make, you have the same opportunities to live a healthy, productive life. And for us to do that, there's sort of three parts of this work and that all happen together and that all influence each other. One of them is really what we're calling community capacity building, which is really working with communities around what communities identify as their priorities. So it's not us coming in and saying teenage pregnancies are a problem in your community. It's really coming from them around what they think is important. And this really is about trying to change their neighborhoods. And we've been doing this for 6 years, and we have some evaluation around it. But that's a big focus of the work, so really changing who we are and our relationship to community. The other piece is really around policy. We can do some of this work in isolated communities, but ultimately, unless we really sort of develop more equity-focused policy, we're not going to be able to change the whole landscape. And so we have been engaged in a process with the Joint Centers for Political and Economic Studies. It's a national Place Matters initiative that has really been focusing in on policies around education, economics, criminal justice, housing, land use, and transportation. What are those policies, and how do you really get community voice? So this is a participatory process of really getting community voice and helping to shape the policies that now our public health department will help advocate for, will provide data for, will help do testimonies for, et cetera. And we were able to get this through the health committee of our Board of Supervisors. So this is sort of a new part of our practice of what we're doing. And then the thing I will say about this is that we've just recently produced a report on the health impacts of foreclosure. There's a presentation tomorrow on that. But that's, in terms of changing practice, working with a housing rights advocacy group around gathering the data, gathering the stories, gathering the policies that need to shift, and really doing that collaboratively is a part of our changing changing practice to achieve health equity. Now, the other thing that is huge is really what is it that we need to do to change as an institution to be able to achieve health equity? Because we're part of an institution. So it's really a questioning of how are we perpetuating the isms and racism and benefits? I mean, we're part of this institution. You know, we all have this kind of same history about how our structures have been created. And so it's really taking an internal look at that. And there's components to that around public health training for all staff, which really includes a section on undoing racism. It includes how to work with communities in a way that really empowers, and also a whole piece on social equity. And the pieces that and we've got a whole strategic plan to move in that area. The pieces I think that are the most difficult to do as an institution are really to do this piece. It's actually not easy. None of this is easy, but it's easier to think about policy and think about those kinds of things. But to really look internally about first increasing awareness so everyone understands what we're talking about in this way, but then really looking at policies and practice and how that plays out around the isms, who's benefiting, who's not internally, is a whole other conversation. So I'm gonna just jump here, sorry, to lessons learned and further what I just started talking about in terms of the issues. So I think lessons learned as an organization, and there's organization on this slide, personal on the next slide, but it's really, they're a little mixed. One is that the critical need, and we've heard this throughout, of building partnerships with different sectors, and working with communities, particularly the communities that are most impacted, so that they help shape the solutions. constantly reflect on difficult issues. These things aren't crystal clear when you start doing the work. And really creating opportunities and time to think about what we're doing, who's benefiting and who's not benefiting, who really has the voice of, you know, the community, because that's always an issue, who's being really represented, how inclusive are these voices of the rest of the community. Communication is critical in this piece. Staying focused on the vision, I think, is what I talked about a little bit, but also recognizing that sometimes it just feels really overwhelming, right? Like one of our colleagues described, it's like Sisyphus rolling that rock up the hill. It's like a very slow-moving process to try to change an institution. So really staying focused on the vision, but breaking it into smaller steps so you can kind of keep going along the way. Engaging diverse staff. And supporting the hiring of diversity, both in terms of race, ethnicity, as well as socioeconomic status, as well as immigration status, all of those things. Really recognizing that this is not a short-term thing. This is not something that you just do lightly. This is like a strong, strong commitment. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to be in a health department where leadership has really engaged in this for the last 10 years in different ways. And I think that's what's really, and really through that, building staff capacity to continue, because leaders will change, but if you've built that staff capacity and you've got a critical mass of people to help move this conversation forward, you can do that. And I think that's what we've been trying desperately to do. And then, you know, I want to say something about the isms. So when we started this whole thing about really thinking about the isms, some of you may know Dr. Kamara Jones, and she talks about different levels of racism. Internalized, personally mediated, and then institutional. And she said, you know, if you're going to focus on anyone, be sure that you don't just focus on the interpersonal, because it's really about changing structures. And so you really need to focus on the institutional racism components of it. And so we started the conversation from that lens, and our trainings have all started from that lens. But the truth of the matter is, you can't just do one of those. You absolutely have to do all three as if you're trying to make any change. And that does require a whole different skill set. It requires a comfort level with very, very difficult topics. It requires a conversation about power and privilege and how that plays out, both in an organization as well as with our partners and you know, the broader community. And I think one of the things that I've just really learned is that there's no way you can do this without conflict. I mean, this is about change, and you have to have conflict. And so it's about trying to get comfortable with that. Because if you're not comfortable with conflict and these really difficult conversations, it's really hard to move. I've said some of this already. I think, again, the long-term view, WHO talks about it taking a generation to close the gap. So this is long, hard work. Critically, and this is not like a fad. This has to be something that we're really, really committed to. Being really flexible about this work, because for us, in terms of a public health department, a lot of it has been about really seeing where people are ready to move forward. And then really building on that. And also really creating opportunities for staff who may not be in a leadership position, but who are really interested in this conversation so that they can help move people around them. And so really leading, you know, having people at all different levels of an organization and all different parts of an organization be part of this process. And we have engaged staff in that way. Reflection. I mean, and I'm going to link this to sort of the isms thing. One of the things that we've been doing, and this is also in the Leadership Institute, we have been working with this gentleman, Dr. Ken Hardy, who's actually a therapist, but he's done a lot of work on how isms play out in the workplace. And he has, you know, he's helping us to really understand that there are tasks for us to do in the workplace. If you're in a position of, well, a couple things. One, he's helping us understand that we are in multiple roles all the time. So, you know, I'm Latina, so I might not feel like I'm in a privileged position, but I'm also the deputy director, so I'm in a very privileged position, right? So understanding those nuances and those changes and how that plays out. And so he actually has tasks that you do. Like, if you're in a position of privilege, here are the things that you need to do if you really want to engage in a conversation to get to the other side, to go through race and the isms to get to the other side. Here are some tasks you have to do. And if you're in a subjugated position, here are some tasks that you have to do in the workplace to move forward. So it's been, if anyone's really interested in it, this man is amazing and incredibly compassionate about how to have these conversations and move things forward. I think the other piece is just, this is hard work. So really figuring out how to take care of yourself in this work. It's a long process, it's hard work. You know, you get into these conversations and you're like, oh man, geez, I just acted in a way that, you know, can help perpetuate how people feel badly about themselves. And so it's like this constant self-reflection. And so once you know, and it's hard, right? It's hard to be in a position of privilege and then see how you're impacting people, even if your intent isn't to do something like that. So I think figuring out ways to have conversations with peers. I think the leadership, a couple things about the Leadership Institute. I think the Leadership Institute creates a forum of people that you can talk to about these issues, so you can get a lot of support from them, and I think that's been very helpful. I think the other piece, the whole notion of the learning community. I think another thing, one of the things I love that we did in this Leadership Institute, okay, the part that I don't like about the Leadership Institute is that we in California don't get to go to Hawaii to have part of our training. The people from Hawaii get to come to California, but we don't get to go to Hawaii. But the thing that I really loved is this opportunity to work with a drama coach who just came totally out of the blue. Like, when in public health do you get to go? I mean, like, I'm not artistic, right? Remember my drawing? So, I mean, that whole drama thing was a whole other thing. But getting someone to come in and work with you around, you know, how to talk about these issues so that you can actually inspire and move people, that was a very cool thing. And then I think where the Institute is going now in terms of trying to have these conversations about the isms and how that plays out in departments are really tricky. I'm just going to end with this slide. This inspires me. So this came out of our The Street Spirit. It's a paper for the homeless population. That's how they get some money. They create the Street Spirit, and then you pay a dollar for it. And they got wind of this project that we were working on with the Housing Rights Advocacy Group around foreclosures. And this is what they said about that work. The light is going out in thousands of foreclosed abandoned houses in our midst. We should support the Public Health Department and Just Cause Oakland for speaking out against a foreclosure crisis that is threatening entire communities. They are fighting against the dying of the light. So that, to me, is what this work on social justice is about. Oh, I'm getting emotional about it. It inspires me in a good way. Okay, so that's it. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Tanya Cook, and I am indeed from the great state of Nebraska. From Omaha, Nebraska, I represent the 13th Legislative District, which is in northeast Omaha. If you've ever flown into Omaha, you've been to Legislative District 13 because the airport is in Legislative District 13. If you saw the film with George Clooney last year, Up in the Air, you've seen the airport, so that should count. Yes, and I'm going to approach my presentation somewhat differently and kind of build to how I got here, which in my belief system is a plan, but to me felt like a big accident and being pushed, kicking, and dragged, kicking and screaming into some of these opportunities. But it's certainly great to be with you today. In fact, this is my birthday, and I can't imagine, thank you, a better way to celebrate. Because we all look back when we have birthdays. I'm going to just stick with my 40th one for till I'm ready to do another one. And so it's just nice to be able to have a day like this and reflect on kind of where you've been and where you want to go. I am, as you can maybe tell from looking at me, African American, which around here means I'm Chinese, Cherokee, Choctaw, Scots Irish, and my family is from the Deep South. Their places of origin are Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for my mother, and my father is from Georgia, from the country, from the woods, from about 80 miles southeast of Savannah, Georgia. They met on an airplane. My father was in the Air Force. And he flirted with her by offering her an Ebony magazine. And here I am today. And so I, when you talk about what spurs my interest in social justice in a context that doesn't really embrace it, shall we say, I'll start minimally and describe my current context as not being as conversant in the language of social justice as the good doctor here. I was a little bit jealous of you describing of the kinds of conversations you can get into on a day-to-day basis. My parents are from the Deep South. I grew up hearing those stories, which lots of people think are just from movies of the week, but people really did get lynched. When I ran for office, my father said, oh yeah, there was a guy that wanted to run for the legislature down there. They hung him. So hearing these stories and hearing stories, my mother was a school teacher. She retired as a university professor, and she graduated from a historically black university, Southern University in Baton Rouge. When she graduated, she had a teaching degree, and she showed it to me once. She was very proud, and she said, this is my first teaching degree, and it only licensed her to teach colored children. Of course, I blew a gasket, but in even her showing it to me, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, that was just the way it was. So she was licensed to teach. She wanted to teach in the area of business education. The East Baton Rouge Parish Public School system was not hiring black teachers to do that or colored teachers to do that. So she worked in Southern's registrar's office for 10 years. And that came in handy, don't worry. So through that nurturance, and certainly that message is reinforced. I happen to be a Baptist, so it's reinforced in our theology, a liberation theology. And through my public school education in Omaha, Nebraska, I felt fortunate to go to a high school that is in downtown Omaha. Our building served as the state territorial capital when Nebraska was just a territory. But the best thing about it was that it was naturalistically diverse before there was such a thing as even planning for diversity. Omaha was under court-ordered busing from the feds, but Central had students from the near north side, which is where the African-American population lived, the near south side with Hispanic Latino, Italian, Polish. Our senior class president was an African-American woman. Her vice president was a Latino male. Sergeant at arms, we had a real live card carrying WASP, a young Irish woman, Italian American male sergeant at arms. So I felt really fortunate to be, especially in a state like Nebraska, to be educated in a diverse environment where we had a great school environment, great school climate. We respected one another. I went on from there to an undergraduate experience at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Go Hoyas. We won the national championship when I was there with our center, Patrick Ewing. And Georgetown, this was my first experience with the Jesuits, who also, in their philosophy, emphasize social justice. And there were many opportunities to be reminded of that through required courses in philosophy and theology and spring break in the Appalachians or things like that that were reinforced in the culture of the institution. From there, after a brief time back in Nebraska, I moved to New York and worked in public relations and had the opportunity to join the campaign of David Dinkins. He was the first African-American mayor of New York City. I worked in a PR firm. For some reason, I thought, well, everybody should work on a political campaign. And I was fortunate enough to be connected to the campaign through a friend of the candidate's and who took the extra time to make certain that I had a fun experience. At the time, people really did stuff envelopes on campaigns. And instead of having that opportunity, I got a chance to work very closely with the finance director and meet all kinds of people and work on a $3 million air war, which won, which is what I recommend for anybody starting out in politics, because then you think it's fun, and then you think you win all the time, and you don't. But at least you get hooked on it in that fashion. So after a few years in New York, there was a recession back then too, and the kind of public relations business that I did focused on the kinds of businesses where budgets shrink. Not only do PR budgets shrink in a recession, but especially PR budgets for upscale restaurants like the 21 Club and the Plaza Atenee Hotel and La Régence and all these places that when business shrinks their budget, they shrink that. So I was unemployed and decided I didn't want to live in New York anymore. It's a great place, but I was accustomed to making eye contact with people on the streets and not having that be weird for them. And many of my friends at that time were leaving New York for law school or marriage or whatever. So I went back to Nebraska, minding my own business. I was recruited onto a city council race for a woman who actually serves with me in the legislature now. And got back involved in politics in that way. A few years later, she recommended my name to I'm a lifelong Democrat. She recommended my name to the Republican then governor to be his liaison to minority communities. And so I became appointed to the governor's office to a person I'd never met before. I was even mispronouncing his name. And he said, well, if you're selling, I'm buying. And I said, well, okay. And I was proudly the liaison from that office. I almost felt as though it was necessary to social justice because he knew that he didn't know, first of all, he didn't know anybody in Omaha, which as he happened to be from Lincoln, he was a former mayor of Lincoln, and that is where you have the bulk of the minority, it's certainly the African-American community, at the time a growing Latino population, and people from all over the world live there. So that is how I came to be I called myself the governor's left hand in the administration of Governor Mike Johanns, who now serves in the United States Senate. So there I was, minding my own business, and then one day I was waiting for the tile guy. He's a union tile guy doing side work. Waiting for the tile guy, going into my office, which at this point was a dual role. I was the governor's director of urban affairs, but I also managed on a day-to-day basis the Office of Minority Health in Omaha for that second congressional district. It includes Omaha and Bellevue, Nebraska. That's where the base is. And I just had the TV on waiting, and then I looked and saw my boss on television standing next to George Bush. And I said, well, what is this about? And I turned up the volume, and he was going on to be the USDA secretary. So I stood there thinking, okay, now what am I going to do? Quickly learned that I was going to continue in my role as governor's director of urban affairs and in the Office of Minority Health. Through that opportunity, I was directed to participate in the Great Plains Public Health Leadership Institute. Dr. Magda Peck, who many of you know, is an outstanding leader, national and international leader in public health, and I'd known her for many years through my previous community work in Omaha, placing students in internships when they were interested in health careers. I'd known her through City Match. They said, you're going to sign up for this. I said, great, I'll have that and 30 boards and committees, and I've got no time for this. P.S., my parents are starting to exhibit the outcomes of their minority health disparities by having strokes and heart attacks and falling down the stairs and running away to the nursing home. So, okay, whatever, fine. I participated, and it was a great transformative opportunity. Our curriculum included not a ropes course, thank goodness, because we were about 6 inches off the ground, but I think we had to pretend there were alligators and we were on logs. We did some trust exercises in a retreat setting. We did a lot of self-evaluation in terms of your values and your strengths and what you want, what you have to offer, the cause of social justice. Another thing that we did, you had a drama coach, we had a storyteller. Because as Magda framed it, which was perfectly correct, whether you are putting together a grant proposal or whether I would be arguing for the adoption of legislation, you are telling a story and weaving a story and having to connect with people who have influence. So we had a storyteller in our curriculum, in addition to media training and some role play, some panelists, including some elected officials and public health directors. As an aside, an upside of Nebraska's history with public health is that we leveraged our tobacco funds toward public health, and that's in statute. From what I understand, other states just kind of filled in budget holes, but ours is statutorily directed to the maintenance of public health departments across the state and toward the expansion at the time of the offices of minority health across the state, capacity building offices of minority health across the state. The highest and best outcome, I think, of the Great Plains Public Health Leadership Institute, which includes the states of Nebraska, South Dakota, and Iowa, for me was being paired in the second year, in the alumni portion, with a peer coach opportunity. And I was in the first cohort, and none of us knew what we were doing. But by the second cohort, there was this opportunity to participate. I was paired with a woman very different from me in terms of her political stripe. She was a public health nurse, or she is a public health nurse from the state of South Dakota. And she and I really connected because the peer coaching just keeps you focused on what you know you need to do anyway. You can vent a little bit, but you really need to be accountable to somebody about the tasks that you're going to perform to get where you say you're going to go. And I was really touched and proud to learn that last year she threw her hat in the ring to join the South Dakota House of Representatives, and she won her election last Tuesday. So Great Plains Public Health Leadership Institute has at least two people who are legally qualified to pass public health legislation, so we're pretty proud of that. And she'll do a great job. As I said, she was a public health nurse, and she's worked with the Native American community in South Dakota, all from hands-on all the way up to policy development. Where was I? So Great Plains Public Health Leadership Institute, I'll say a little bit, how many? Thank you. A little bit about my career in the legislature. I was elected 2 years ago, 2008. In a historic election all over the place, so that was exciting, and started right away to try to include public health as part of my agenda. Not a popular thing, certainly in hard economic times, and unfortunately I have some bad news about what Nebraska did in the last couple of years related to public health. I won't even talk about my bills, which went out in a flames, but I'll talk about one that we are determined, the friendlies are determined to do something about. We accidentally made the national news on this, but I'll remind you, Nebraska got a letter from CMS, from the administration, that said, oh, by the way, you know that prenatal care that you have, you get to cover that under your own chip. You know, thank you very much, goodbye. Well, our governor happens to be extremely political. That's putting it mildly. He just does, and it works for him. He thinks of things in political terms. So what he determined to do was to put that, he said, you know what, this has been done administratively for the last 30 years, presumptive eligibility for prenatal care for every woman showing up, regardless of immigration status. I think I'll put it out in this election year to the legislature so that they can vote on it. What he wanted to do is get people on the record, do a mailing in many, many counties in Nebraska, unfortunately including parts of my county, where the most remote and oblique reference to supporting immigration, anything for an immigrant, anybody who's not here legally, is political suicide. So that's what he did, and that's what happened because they were afraid to bring it to the floor. Not only would it not go, but then people who know, this is my favorite part, is that many of my colleagues are pro-life. Good for them. They're probably sincerely pro-life. I happen to be pro-choice life, so people ideally, wouldn't every baby be conceived and born into a healthy situation? Wouldn't that be awesome? I make policy out of our reality and not out of how even my own fantasies about how children come to be here. So that happened. That was embarrassing. That was disheartening. But that's something that happened this year. We'll have to go back. At the end of the session, we were able to adjust the law so that, to amend the law so that if a woman, a citizen, had missed, let's say she'd missed an employment first appointment due to domestic violence, then she may reapply to the agency for prenatal care. But it scared so many people away. What happened is that an upside of the Omaha community is that we have a great number of left-leaning philanthropists with hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, and sometimes they just write the check because they know. And many of them wrote checks to me, but that is a saving grace of our area, these pockets of what I call my tribe, that when I'm in the body in Lincoln, I look around and think, who are these people, and do they really live in the same state that I do? But they do, but that's a saving grace of Nebraska. You asked earlier about balance, and I'll segue into that into my last minute or so. I'm trying to have balance. I think the word no is a good word for people like us who do a lot of community work and do things in our faith communities and in our families. Just learning to say no, and not even necessarily being that polite about it. No, no means no. No, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I also remember when I was in the governor's office, and then I left to do some of that caregiving with the parents doing their thing. And I noticed that the invitations all of a sudden dropped off. I don't know why. I'm the same person. So now that the invitation, these same people that didn't have a high need for me to be at these events for those couple of years when I was doing consulting and taking care of family things, it's real easy for me to say no thank you to them because we kind of know where they're coming from, don't we? And that's fine, and that's a beautiful thing. That's a gift for me, who's someone who has served in different aspects of politics and governance. So I stick close to my tribe. I have a memory of what, you know, this is a role. I'm honored to be in the role, but they aren't friends, you know, and I need to accept invitations from friends and family. So with that, I hope you're able to derive something from that, and thanks again for helping me celebrate my birthday.
Many of them are regional.
I'm Claudia Kagan. I'm from Fort Worth,
haven't developed yet.
Right, but they're going to.
Hi, I'm Jenny Mullins, and I did mention to many of you already that I am the director of the Southwest Public Health Leadership Institute, which is based out of Arizona, the University of Arizona, but we have a Leaders Across Borders Institute that is serving all of the US-Mexico border, all four US states and all six of the Mexican states. And I'd like to invite you, Anne, to the General Public Health Leadership Society.
Hi, I'm Anne Nguyen. I'm the program coordinator for the Public Health Leadership Society. And one of the things that came out of the Leadership Institute, Carol, 1993, some of the alumni decided that they really wanted to continue their leadership experiences, learning experiences, so they created the Public Health Leadership Society, which is an alumni organization for folks that have completed the Leadership Institute to continue networking with their peers and also continue their learning processes, and also a forum to really advocate for leadership development as well as other important public health issues. So for our panelists, we welcome you to join the Public Health Leadership Society to connect with others as well.
Thank you, Anne. And I direct the California Wide Public Health Leadership Institute. And yeah, this business about we don't get to go to Hawaii. You don't know how many times people tell
me.
So what I'm doing is I'm now separating California and Hawaii. Actually, we're helping Hawaii develop a leadership institute that will eventually serve the Pacific Islands and territories, which are in real need of leadership development. California's a pretty darn big state, so I got my hands full with California. But we're in our second year. So Sandra, you know, this is an interesting thing about, as I said, about the leadership institutes, bringing in people that are already leaders. In our institute, we are organizational change-based, and so we have many organizations that come in that I consider our early adapters to this work in health disparities and health inequities and social justice. And San Bernardino County have been doing this work for 10 years. They're a very early adapter organization. And I wanted to ask you, Sandra, if you could comment about why you came into the institute and what you're helping the institute, what the institute's helping you to do, because that third ball down in the corner about institutional change is really, if you'd comment on that for a moment. And the rest of you might think about what it was about your institute experience that stands out a bit and contributes to your leadership, if you would, just real quickly.
Yeah, I think the piece that got us interested in the whole thing was the focus on health equity. Because I do remember at the beginning of the conversation on just, you know, building leadership in public health departments, which is great and really necessary, but if it didn't have a focus on health equity and social justice, it felt like it wouldn't be quite as meaningful to us. And so I think part of that, and we had discussions early on, but I think that focus is what really drew us in. And I think in terms of we're sending more people to the leadership, and I think it's really about creating that critical mass within a health department that have that shared understanding. And I think this, and Carol's right in that we have a whole series of trainings that I mentioned already within our public health department to try to get everybody on board and to at least have that shared understanding. But I think the institute helps further that conversation and get into issues a little bit deeper. So I think for us, it's been a great way of thinking about how we continue to build staff capacity around some of those issues.
What stands out about my experience is the opportunity to clarify my values and strengths. As I mentioned earlier, having served a Republican governor or two, let's say one and a half, it could be easy to, I won't say buy their arguments, but in a state like Nebraska, there's not a lot of reinforcement for the kinds of things that are de rigueur in when I was in New York City, for example, or with colleagues that I know through my work in the minority community and on that blue dot in Omaha. We call it the blue dot because it offered one electoral vote to Obama in 2008, and we were pretty excited about that, in a very red state. So I think it was an affirming opportunity to look at the piece of paper and say, see, Tanya, you're not crazy. And to also, with that opportunity, identify individuals within the community and across the state and around the region who were like-minded.
And that probably follows a little along the way at our institution that Senator Cook is talking about. The fact that we at the school, which were previously a department, we continued to have the conversation that there was a lack of diversity, especially on all levels there. But the conversation, and had tried different ways to try to address that, but had not maybe taken one particular route to say, how do we want to address that? And so that was one of the ways that what I tried to do is tie back into our accreditation process, because you really do have to address, that's a whole section when it comes to the accreditation process, student diversity, faculty diversity, staff diversity. What are you going to do about that? Yes, we know it's an issue when it comes to schools of public health, but what are you going to do? Show us exactly what you're going to do. So that's what I tried to do when I addressed the project, is trying to say how that can then be tied into what the school's mission and vision is.
Great. Very good. I heard a lot of risk-taking in yours. You made a good point about that. Some of you missed that. Some risk-taking that you took early on, and that's a big part of leadership. I'm going to open it up now. Who would like to address our panelists? Yes, and would you stand up and say where you're from?
No problem. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
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 Hi. Good afternoon.
I'm Deanna Allen from Nashville, Tennessee, at our Metro Public Health Department. I'm also a current fellow in the Maternal and Child Health Public Health Leadership Institute, and I'm not sure if the MCHPHLI is a part of the larger network. I'll ask Dr. Fernandez when I see her next week, making sure that we're a part of that. So I just wanted to say thank you as someone who is in an institute, a public health institute training program right now, that those emerging issues around health equity and finding a voice and a platform and connection with colleagues who are doing the work around the country is extremely helpful. I have two questions. So first question for Sandra. I appreciated in your presentation talking about we can't run from addressing the institutional racism and the institutional health equity issues. So at my health department, as a part of my leadership project in the fellowship, looking at doing some chart reviews or some sort of assessment to look at actually the health outcomes to see what we're doing as a department, either in like our, I'll give you an example, like in our family planning clinics, are we less likely to prescribe a certain contraceptive or counseling for certain groups of people? And there's certainly a lot of demographic variables that can go into that equation. So I'm curious if you have some recommendations or assessments or tools or can direct me to finding kind of a solid platform to stand on. My institution, it is what it is. We have a long way to go and we're really just getting started. And I can see the door closing very quickly on a conversation about health equity and what our role is in contributing to those health outcomes that I see. And then my question for the other two are...
I get one question. Because we have to get one question.
So we have sort of developed a practice around looking at our health outcome data and mapping our health outcome data. And that, I think, has been really very powerful. You know, the statistic that I showed about 50 years in life expectancy, to actually see that on a map and see red, yellow, green areas, I think has been really powerful and leads you quickly to the conversation around to place. And why are these poor health outcomes concentrated in particular places? So I think analyzing the data that you do have available to be able to look at it by geographic area, if you're able to do that, in terms of just health outcome data through birth files and death files, that's just a start. I think it's a huge place, entry point to have the conversation. And then there's more like you were talking about, sort of like analysis of healthcare service differentials kind of thing. And that depends very much on the kind of data that's being collected by each program. But I'd be happy to talk to you a little bit more after the session.
Ben Duncan with Multnomah County Health Department. I also chair the board of Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. I will say Multnomah County Health Department, can I ask a clarifying and then a question?
Multnomah,
yes. So clarification I wanted for Dr. Witt. At Alameda, is the Board of Health also going through the trainings?
Yes,
and I will say, the reason I ask is because at Multnomah County, our executive leadership, our Board of Health is our Board of County Commissioners, and their whole executive team is going through an undoing institutional racism.
Wow.
Which is,
awesome.
Let's hope.
Yeah, so the quick answer to your question is we know, but that is really been acted out.
Okay.
This process that I've described mostly has been really about changing public health department practice. But in that conversation, being able to work with other sectors and other agencies, around transportation, housing, all of those kinds of things, we've been moving into that conversation. And so we're at a public health department, and we prioritize getting community and community input into the process first, and then doing the agency and cross-agency work. So we would love to get to where you and people at King County are lavish about it, but that's absolutely the world.
Sure. So my real question, and partly I ask this because I feel like I've had a lot of these opportunities. I have great mentors and coaches and people that have supported me. And I feel like all of you have had a lot of those same opportunities, or, as Ms. Fayette was saying, had the bravery or the courage to actually go to the dean, which I don't think is a quality that everybody has, so I just commend you. But I'm wondering if the Leadership Institutes, is there equity and access to leadership opportunities? Is it something that's really been difficult for us, in my area of public health, to look at whether it's line staff or young people of color that are coming into the health department and don't have those relationships, don't have that experience, and don't necessarily have sometimes the courage to be able to speak truth to power or even to to ask for those opportunities. And it's been really difficult. I can keep saying it and run this thing, but it's really difficult to convince people to find those opportunities. And I'm curious whether the Leadership Institute has done that, or what the plan is to do it.
I actually did receive a scholarship from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, Office of Health Disparities. They actually offer scholarships to people of color who are interested in going into the leadership program. And Cherise Hunt is here, who I think of as a mentor and who was the person that was instrumental in me being able to take advantage of the opportunity. So I think they sponsored 5 of us last year to go, and then there's other opportunities around the state as well.
I was directed to go to the Leadership Institute, but in my role as Governor's Director of Urban Affairs and also within the Office of Minority Health, I was directed by the governor and took it on as just as a personal mission to reach out for people who weren't always on that top 10 list to be included. The formalized head of the Hispanic Center, the formalized head of the, instead of reaching out to these same people who are on 50 boards, they never go to the meetings, I wanted to reach out to the informal leaders or to the people who were doing the grassroots work within the communities who had direct experiences. To that end, under my governor's direction, we created the governor's advisory cabinet, diversity advisory cabinet, and that was a kitchen cabinet. So that included some folks who I wanted to get, but not formalized leaders. I ended up kind of with the middle folks versus what I considered real people, so I felt like I was getting somewhere. Another aspect of the Leadership Institute that that built on that idea, our capstone project, if you will, was a poster project, and my partner and I did one on succession planning, which leveraged the imagery from Dr. Jones's garden.
Right.
And so those were 2 ways we tried.
Great. And I think you all should have a list of the leadership institutes around the country. They were on the back page to get one. And one of them, anybody else want one? I would encourage you, this is a dilemma for us. We're not big enough and robust enough to handle all the needs for leadership development, but I would strongly encourage you to talk to your institute, serve your state, and talk about how you can make the leadership development opportunities for emerging leaders more robust, and how you can work together, and where the energy and discussion might take place. That does require some resources, but you know, I think if a bunch of 2-3 in-kinds got together, you could begin to really do something. And a state is a good geopolitical entity to work in. It's very hard to launch these national things. And you really want the networking to happen within the state and the partnerships to happen within the state. state. So don't give up. It's a great idea, but I'd say talk to people like us about your needs. Yes?
Just to kind of piggyback, it's related to this discussion. I was with the State Health Department and the Office of Health Disparities. We shifted our Office of Minority Health dollars and equated a leadership component. So every year in our 500 grants that we could send by people of color to participate in these leadership programs. And then, so if you know, from a local health departments can do the same, state health departments. So it's being creative with your funds, because that's capacity building at a community level. And so when you think about the sustainability, the work that Fayette is doing at the School of Public Health, it reflects well on the state health department in our interventions to promote diversity, to eliminate disparities. So having that conversation at the state level with your health department, or the state health departments, and talking about how can we blend funds, working with the also some of your local foundations, everyone likes leadership development. So it's just being strategic, and you can make that happen.
Good point. Thank you very much for contributing that.
I really appreciated Dr. Witt's presentation, the slide that showed the medical model next to the social ecological model, and the point that you made about how a lot of attention tends to be on the medical side. And to me, it seemed like that could kind of points the way of a role for public health departments in addressing social determinants and inequities. But it reminded me, as I heard you talk about that some conversations that have occurred at the conference here that have made distinctions between population health and public health. And I think that mirrors what you describe. Not that there's any kind of insidious intent behind that distinction, but I guess the concern that's coming up to me is that going to result in funding being like a distinction in funding as well? And I guess to the panelists, I just wonder if you have heard similar things, or if you have do you see a concern in this kind of thing?
So I can just start by, so I haven't been involved in those conversations about the distinction between population and health to public health, so I'm not exactly sure what you're saying, but it is really clear that how our funding works is mostly around what was on that framework around the biomedical model, right? It's really not about engaging with others, very little, engaging with other sectors around, you know, built environment issues and how transportation issues get developed, and thinking about doing health impact assessments on the impact of certain policies. So clear, I mean, how we do that is, if we're lucky, a little bit of foundation help, but mostly through the little bits of our own net county costs. So we have sort of said, we've just prioritized and said a little bit of flexible dollars that we have, we're putting into expanding our public health practice. But it'd be helpful to have you say a little bit about the distinction that you were hearing about public health.
The way I understood it was the population health concept relates to clinical care delivered in primary care and FQA, federally qualified health centers. And I know, like, in the last round of, or the first round of funding that came out of the Public Health Trust Fund, that a chunk of that was, the $500 million was cleaved out to FQHCs, which isn't a bad thing, but making that distinction at the federal level from the federal agencies, I'm just wondering whether that's going to lead to kind of pushing off the ability to address health inequities and social determinants to the funding that you could, like, luckily get from other sources.
I want to put that on the parking lot thing, because this is a huge subject, and I would love it if some of us could stay afterwards to talk about it a little bit. But I'd like to get, if you don't mind, Joffrey, I'd really like to get back to the leadership story. And so questions to our panelists about their journey, what they're doing, the Leadership Institute experience. You had one. Would you like to? Anybody new?
I do actually have a question. I was very interested in the idea that two of you at least talked about wanting to leverage entry points. So, Dr. Witt, in your case, organizational change needed to be hooked onto something, right? That
tell you my story of what resonated and made really clear that we had to go in this direction. So, and again, my comment about we're really good about looking externally around how structural racism plays out, but then, you know, looking internally, that's a whole other conversation. And I'm sure this happens everywhere, so I'll just tell my story, but we all know it's happening everywhere. So a lot of the comments that we would get in terms of public health department and staff would be like, you know, those women, they really don't need money for transportation, you know, because if they really care about their children, they bring their children and get the programs. Another comment, there were a lot of rapidly changing demographic areas, and so in one of our communities, a lot of tension among African-Americans and Latinos in this community, and so we brought in, you know, people that know how to engage in that conversation, and staff sort of held back, and this person came up to me and said, this woman came up to me and she goes, can you speak, can we participate in this conversation? It was all about understanding, it was understanding the history and how communities get settled and why African-Americans are living in this place and Latinos are living here and trying, you know, it was a fascinating dialogue that was happening, and the staff person just kind of looked at me and said, no, can I talk, and I'm like, no, this is really about getting here and giving you the voice, we're just here to support, you know, no, you can't speak up. And she just couldn't hold back. She just could not hold back, and she had to sort of talk. And the things that were coming out of her mouth were actually like making things worse in terms of, you know, we're supposed to be bridging, our public health departments were supposed to be bridging these relationships, and she was just like saying things that I was going like, oh my gosh, this person is, first I was really upset because like I'm supposed to be a boss, right, for this opportunity, so that's the whole thing. But then, once I got over that, I was like, I got two things out of it. One was, people need to talk about race and racism, and people do want to talk about it when you can create a space for that. And that's what I got from her, was I was like, you know, once I got over being angry about, you know, where the direction it was going, it was like, we need to sort of think about that, because if we ignore this kind of stuff, this is what our staff people in communities are doing. And so what's our responsibility as an institution, and how are we contributing further to bring it on? So that was really kind of the beginning of kind of like, okay, we absolutely have to do something. And then that led to using a tool, Raise the Power of the Illusion, which is produced by California Newsreel, which I think does a really, really good job of talking about racism and structural racism and how that has played out. And so those were the beginnings of conversations. And then, you know, Ken Hardy, who I mentioned before, really always talks about, you know, it's one thing to increase awareness, it's another thing to increase sensitivity, and that we're really good at increasing awareness, but not sensitivity. And so that's been the shift to why I mentioned those tools that he's got to sort of help us engage in that kind of dialogue. So that was just our entry point.
Yeah. You know, we've got about 2 minutes left. Sarah Birding.
It's pretty grooming. I'm curious about the storytelling and then the drama as part of this, because one of the things that feels difficult is, and maybe you can speak, especially being in Nebraska rather than Alameda County or like Portland, Oregon, but the idea of social justice politically, I mean, how do you tell the story of social justice and sell it as, you know, or health equity as a priority or as something that should be a public concern when, you know, equitable distribution of resources and social justice in the, you know, in some media circles and some political discourse is not something that just resonates with people.
Not only does it not resonate with many people, especially in the current dialogue, shall we say, or monologue, it people are actually offended by it and will resist it if they recognize it to be anything, like if you use the actual words, social justice or diversity or equity or inclusiveness or anything like that. And you think you kind of answered your own question. When we frame it in telling the story of a community and linking it to the shared values of the state or of the community, then you're saying, no, you don't want, for example, the city of Omaha has near top nationally in rankings for African-American poverty, African-American males not graduating from high school, infant mortality, they've got the national record for STIs, STDs. So telling that story, and not so much shaming, but telling the story like, hey, we're this, we've got the most millionaires per capita, yet we're this. Now, how does that story, you know, How does that, are you part of the solution for this? Does this fit into what we describe as our mutual values or not? And then at the end of your grant proposal or your story, you say, and this is how you can help. You can advance this bill. You can fund this grant proposal. You can fill in the blank.